The first thing I remember about Peanut Island was the water was crystal blue. I hadn't been boating in a very long time at that point back in 2017 when my friend's dad took us all out onto the water. It was spring break and we were eager to enjoy the views of Florida's Atlantic coast from out at sea. We'd dive into the water from the boat, go fishing off the back as it roared over the waves, and zip around the islands of the coast, seeing what strange sights we could find. We'd wander along tropic islands the entire day, marveling at the nooks and crannies that could only be witnessed by boat. That's something I've always been fascinated by, the hidden things that can't be found by just driving over a bridge. The boat may be the only way to find it. But we found ourselves on an unusual little spot, Peanut Island. And on Peanut Island, we discovered an extremely unusual tourist attraction which sent me down a rabbit hole that brought me to today's episode. Peanut Island is home to a presidential nuclear bunker. But Peanut Island itself has a strange origin, as its name might suggest. Technically, it's an artificial island just along West Palm Beach. The whole mass of land that runs along West Palm Beach and the lagoon next to it was chopped and screwed throughout the late 1800s and early 1900s, dredging up canals and creating artificial lagoons along the coast. Essentially, there's a strip of land that runs by the sea with a lagoon between that strip of land and the mainland. That is the Lake Worth Inlet. In that area, throughout the turn of the century, land was dredged from inland toward the lagoon in order to drain the natural freshwater from interior parts of the state. Quote, pollutants from untreated freshwater discharges and sewage was released into the lagoon, causing poor water quality, end quote. The plan to counteract this freshwater nightmare was to pour in salt water from the ocean to clean out that nasty freshwater with rushing fresh seawater. To compensate for the dredging, the state decided to, you guessed it, do more dredging. The result is a very strange map from above with little cut-throughs in the middle of all of this land and islands peppered along the coast of West Palm Beach that weren't there two centuries ago. Ecologists have worked for years to amend some of the damage of the dredging to this ecosystem, but the scars have remained in strangely evident ways. For example, the circular island in the middle of the lagoon made up, no joke, of the dredging material from the various dredging projects. That is Peanut Island. It's like an island made up of garbage from other parts of the state. It's like if you scooped out the state and put all those parts that you scooped out and made Peanut Island. Apparently, the Peanut name comes from an alleged attempt to run peanut oil company on the island of some kind, to ship peanut oil from that island. I'm not sure, but look at Peanut Island on a map. What does it look like to you? Because to me, it kind of looks like when you crack open a peanut. I don't know. Seems like a more logical reason for it to have its name. Well, either way, Peanut Island has become a tourist spot with a pier for boats and campgrounds to stay on the island, and indeed, the water is beautiful. There's even a man-made reef to visit in the clear waters of this strange, false island. You can only reach it by boat, making it a special, strange trip. Maybe it was that strangeness that drew us there in the first place, and that strangeness that brought us below the surface into maybe the weirdest tourist trap I have ever entered, the Kennedy Bunker. It is closed now, closing in 2017, actually the year that we went, though the county has expressed plans to maybe reopen it. It was originally owned as a nonprofit where a museum ran from 1999 until it was closed. It had been hidden and forgotten for decades up to that point, the lost relic of an unusual period in American history. You see, President John F. Kennedy vacationed in this area for many years, and during his presidency, when he was increasingly afraid of nuclear warfare, a bunker was created to keep him safe inside. It was strange to be within it, a place of fear and anxiety for the president from so many years earlier. Its construction feels like a thing of fiction to us now, and being inside felt like another world, like the illusion of security in a dangerous place, acknowledging a dangerous world outside. Strolling through the bunker in a t-shirt and khakis like it was any old museum just felt wrong, though I maybe didn't know it at the time. Feels weird to me now. When these bunkers were built, they were built out of a very real fear, for very real reasons, and this bunker is far from the only one. Many miles north, in the tiny, wonderful town of Mount Dora, Florida, there is another bunker. Its location hidden from time, its reasoning more complicated than the presidential bunker, and its potential occupants are more startling to us. The bunker on Peanut Island was for the president and became a museum many years later. The Mount Dora bunker, the one we're talking about today, is also known as the Mount Dora Catacombs. And the Mount Dora bunker, it was for a select number of only rich families in the area. And its location is mostly unknown to the public to this day. It's an abandoned place beneath our feet, with many secrets left still in its walls. I'm Nick D'Alessandro, and this is Wait 5 Minutes, a podcast about Florida by a Floridian. Sometimes you hear a story and it's so shocking, you almost don't believe it. Sometimes you start scratching the surface and find something even more startling the deeper you go. The Mount Dora Catacombs is one of those stories, a story of history, paranoia, and fear, all occurring in one of the most beautiful historic towns in the state. I've been waiting for this one for a while, but now it's time. Let's go searching for the Mount Dora Catacombs. To begin, let's meet an author, Pat Frank. Born in Chicago in 1907, Pat moved to the University of Florida to study journalism in his young adulthood. He worked in Jacksonville as a journalist before moving north to work in New York and Washington, D.C. He was a true blue newspaper man, writing about every major story throughout his career, including World War II, where he covered the war extensively until transitioning into, I'm not kidding here, he transitioned into writing propaganda for the American government. His official title was propagandist. What a bizarre career. When he returns from the war, he starts writing about his experiences, publishing political comics, and he soon focused in on a topic that would be a large part of the rest of his career, his fear of nuclear warfare. His first book, Mr. Adam, is about a nuclear accident making men infertile. Okay. The rest of his novels followed similar themes: the rise of the Cold War, tensions with Soviet Russia, the recovery of American life after the war, but always with this anxiety of nuclear power. He wrote a book called Forbidden Area, which I have bought to read. I'll report back to you soon. And that's about a group of Soviet spies that arrive to North Florida and blend into American life to sow chaos. I'll report back after I give it a read. But the book most relevant to today's topic is perhaps his most famous. It is called Alas, Babylon. Ooh, good title. Alas, Babylon is set in a fictional Florida town called Fort Repose. Pat Frank actually wrote the book near Mount Dora, and the town serves as the inspiration for the town in the book. Mount Dora is Fort Repose. The story of the book is that a nuclear war occurs, but Fort Repose survives, and the book follows the small town as it grapples with life after the world has ended. The book's very existence is bone-chilling to me, especially when you consider this essential detail, the detail that sparked this entire story. The book was published in 1959. It scared the real people of Mount Dora. It's based on Mount Dora, and the people of Mount Dora took it as, I mean, I'm putting words in their mouth, but it feels almost like it was taken as a prophecy. Soon, the people of Mount Dora set about building a bunker, a fallout shelter, to prepare for the world that Pat Frank's Alas, Babylon predicted. Before we go any further from here, I have to tell you the two main sources for this. There is an amazing website called Abandoned Florida. They did a really fantastic piece called The Mount Dora Catacombs with a lot of research and photographs. There is also an article from Pulse Magazine. It was published almost 2 decades ago, but I will include links to both of these pieces as they were my main sources for this. So please go give those a read. There are photographs. We'll talk about those more in a moment, but a lot of what we get going forward comes from these two main sources. All right. In the extensive articles about the existence of the catacombs, which includes many photos and diagrams, the Abandoned Florida article actually opens with the existence of the book, Alas, Babylon. I'd never heard of it until I read this article, and I suddenly was like, that is so unsettling that these things are connected, and it's what prompted me to look up the book and Pat Frank himself. Because I've grown up going to Mount Dora. I'm from Seminole County. Mount Dora's not very far from here. It's been a nice tradition on Christmas or in the summer, or if you ever want to go shopping. I've eaten Cuban food on Main Street. I've gone to various museums in that area. I've shopped in their marvelous bookstore. I've walked along the waterfront. I've had holiday meals there. Mount Dora is like a part of life for me in Central Florida. Florida. Mount Dora, if you've never been, is a perfectly quaint Florida downtown with history, culture, and beautiful old homes everywhere you look. So when I learned of this bunker and this book, it kind of shifted my relationship with the city that I thought I knew very well, and it revealed how complicated even the most simple of towns could be. Mount Dora is a rare town in Florida that actually has elevation, so the title of Mount is not a misnomer, it's accurate. At 184 feet above sea level, the city sits on top of a mountain, albeit a Florida mountain, a small mountain. So that is where the mount comes from. As for Dora, who is Dora? Well, that's a question without a definitive answer. According to the city's official history, there is a conflicting narrative that I find quite funny. They say there was a woman named Dora Andrade. She was a homesteader in the area back in the 1800s. There were apparently surveyors in the area at the time, mapping the land and naming the landmarks in the region. The story goes that in 1846, pay attention to the years here, in 1846, they named the massive lake at the edge of town after the hospitable woman who lived nearby. Thus, Lake Dora was born. The town was then subsequently named for the lake. But this is where it gets a little funky. So the official record says that the lake was actually named in 1848, but census records don't show this Dora Andrade in Florida in 1850. She was not in Florida in 1850, she was actually in Georgia. She moved to the region sometime in the ensuing decade between 1850 and 1860. So, if it was called Lake Dora in records from 1848, but she didn't live there until after 1850, the whole friendly lady gets the lake named after her story is not looking too good. That means that very likely the lake was not named for her. She wasn't even around when the lake became Dora. Without that story, there doesn't seem to be an answer. Perhaps it was named for some surveyor's mother, or daughter, or girlfriend. That certainly was how the town got its first name. It was actually originally called Royallou. Royallou? R-O-Y-E-L-L-O-U. You tell me how to say that. It was named for the postmaster's kids. The postmaster was named Ross Tremaine. And as you know from many episodes of the show, once you get a post office, now you're a town. But every town needs a name. So Tremaine provided one. Quote, "The town was known as Royallou at the time, unofficially named for Tremaine's three children, Roy, Ella, and Lewis." End quote. Thus, Royallou. That's good. So that's 1880. By 1883, Mount Dora was the official name, and the little hamlet was born. Don't know where the Dora came from, though. It expanded the way all towns did at that time through tourism. Hotels opened to attract winter tourists, specifically to hunt in the wilderness surrounding this mountaintop town. With the train line coming soon after, so too did tourists and famous names. Quote, "Visitors included Presidents Coolidge and Eisenhower, Thomas Edison, and Henry Ford," end quote. We're going to have to do an episode soon about how Edison and Ford literally went everywhere together. They were best friends. Anyway. Naturally, citrus came to town, but fell, as it did everywhere in the state of Florida, by 1895 because of the Great Freeze, which ruined so many towns' citrus industries at that time. Citrus helped the town grow, but without it, they had to figure out a way to move forward. Luckily, the fertilizer industry kept the town afloat. The city expanded and developed between the wars into the quaint, lovely town that it is today. Home to year-round festivals, beautiful views over the lake, and apparently there's an annual regatta. I guess it was like 2 weeks ago. I guess I'll have to attend. I gotta see those boats. Anyway, I tell you all this because it is a classic historic Florida downtown. Thrift shops, restaurants, old homes, history laid out on fence posts, old hotels on the water. There's a hidden restaurant called the Goblin Market. There's a cafe that overlooks Main Street. There's a modernism museum. It's not a town that belies a secret dark history. It is, as it seems to be, historic, friendly, and unique. It's perhaps the last town that you would expect to have a structure beneath it that is defined as a catacombs. And yet, catacombs there are. Now, let's meet Dr. James Basil Hall. He came to Mount Dora in 1949, originally from Tennessee. In the 1960s, at the height of the Cold War, the good doctor was the Lake County Health Director. It was a scary time in the world. After World War II, tensions between the Soviet Union and the United States continued to escalate, with both sides pointing their respective nuclear artillery at each other and wondering who would fire first. This anxiety would launch, pun intended, several historical events into motion: the Cuban Missile Crisis, the space race, etc. It is maybe one of the most influential events and periods of American history that we've talked about on this show. We talk about it all the time because the Cold War, 1947 into the 60s, I mean, it was hugely formative on so many things. But we don't talk enough about what it was like for just regular old people. People were afraid, especially during the Cuban Missile Crisis, of what was coming next. Consistently, Americans were afraid of the bomb dropping, especially as Russia proved that they weren't afraid to send warning messages. With the launch of Sputnik 1 in 1957, Russia heightened that paranoia. It was just a beeping ball that rotated around the atmosphere of the planet, but now it was an intimidation tactic. The USSR put it up there. What was America going to do next? Small town America was afraid. Dr. James Basil Hall, he was afraid. The book, Alas Babylon, that really amped up their anxiety because it was about their worst nightmare. Because it was about them. I mean, imagine a book comes out that's about your tiny little town and it's a terrifying near future perspective sci-fi story. I'd be pretty freaked out. I mean, I understand why Dr. James Basil Hall was like, "What? Why would you say that, Pat Frank?" And that's what sparked this anxiety to really ramp up. A plan was formed alongside other leaders. It included a citrus magnate, a leader in the paper industry, a boat builder, all interested in creating a shelter. Not a fallout shelter or a bomb shelter. They called it a quote-unquote group survival shelter. Remember, people, publicity is everything. The idea was to make it large enough to house many people, not just one or two families. The plan included 25 families. We'll talk about them more in a moment. But what really fascinates me is how this thing was built. It was created in plain sight. An article from Pulse magazine, which is hilariously titled Gimme Shelter, A-plus title there, it details many of the finer points of the bunker alongside our friends at Abandoned Florida. This bunker is the largest privately owned nuclear shelter in the country, or at least it was in the 1960s. The Pulse says that the bunker was built, quote, 6 feet under an orange grove at the edge of Mount Dora, end quote. That's just incredible. Abandoned Florida says that the person who owned the land at the time, he actually had to come up with a lie to cover from wandering eyes. Quote, the landowner told those that came around asking that he was merely building a croquet court. A grass croquet court was built on top of the shelter, end quote. That's just so funny. If you're wondering what croquet is, it's that game with the little hammers and the arches like Alice in Wonderland. It seems, though, that it was built under an orange grove. I don't see anything of the croquet field today, but it seems like there was one perhaps at the time. That at least was the cover story. As the Pulse points out, beneath the surface of Florida's land is hard to build on in most other locations. Most houses don't have basements around here. The water level is very high, and there's a ton of sand. So if you dig down, you can't really build down there. Mount Dora, however, is atop its own little mountain. It is perfect for digging into. But where it wound up is relatively unknown, though internet sleuths have done their level best to use public records and context to track down the location. One extensively researched Reddit post indicates that a large spot of land may be directly above the old bunker. They think that they found it. What's on that land today? Well, it looks like orange groves to me, just as the history indicates. Its location has never been publicly disclosed in order to maintain the privacy of the owners on the land today, and I want to respect that as well. But I do see, based on the research, an orange grove. The plot of land is massive because the bunker itself was surprisingly very large. For comparison, though, let's go back to Peanut Island, JFK's bunker on the tiny island, formerly known as Detachment Hotel. It was built in 1960, just after Kennedy was elected, and it, quote, consisted of a corrugated steel shelter covered with 25 feet of concrete, earth, and lead, end quote. Hidden behind a line of trees nearby the Coast Guard station that was built in 1936, that is where the bunker hides. Quote, the main room housed 15 bunk beds, a desk, and conference table, end quote, alongside a communication center. The intention of the bunker was always to be a temporary hiding spot if, heaven forbid, the president needed it. Because of that, its capacity was relatively small. Quote, Detachment Hotel could shelter Kennedy, up to 30 family members, and a group of close advisors for roughly 1 month, end quote. That was luckily never tested. But I was inside that bunker, and though my memory is fuzzy, I wouldn't exactly call it a roomy location. And that was the bunker for the president. Imagine how big the catacombs are for 25 families, okay? In comparison, the Mount Dora bunker should have maybe been called a hotel instead of the Peanut Island bunker. This wasn't just designed for 30 or so people for a month. It was designed for 25 families to survive for 6 months. 6 months at least. It was 5,000 square feet, which isn't massive, but big enough to fit a lot inside. To enter the bunker, you'd pass through its disguised entrance, a utility shed, which I guess is still there today, according to the articles, or at least it was about 2 decades ago. Then you would pass through a, quote, 2,000-pound blast-proof steel door, end quote. You'd go down the stairs and find everything that you would need inside. A fuel tank, a water tank, a well, a generator. There was a, quote-unquote, decontamination room, which would be used if one had become exposed to radiation. There's a pretty macabre detail here. There was a burial crypt in case someone didn't make it. There were dehumidifiers and air conditioning, the sort of climate control that one needed to keep an underground apartment complex in Florida. It was a place designed to be lived in. Quote, the complex had more than 30 rooms, including 25 private living quarters for each family. There were 2 communal bathrooms, each with 3 showers, commodes, and wash basins, end quote. There was a kitchen, of course, with loads of canned supplies and a fully equipped medical center and weapons in case anyone tried to enter the shelter uninvited. And remarkably, it's not like this place sat empty awaiting the mad rush of the approved residents waiting to come hide if, when, anything went wrong. Rather, the families who were allowed to use the bunker, they already had stuff in their rooms. They brought clothing and personal items that they may have wanted with them if things went south. It's not like they signed up for the shelter and never thought about it again. They ran a drill in the shelter. Quote, the shelter was used only once when the group stayed one night as part of a drill, end quote. Come on, kids, pack your bags. We're going to go stay in the bunker where we'll hide if the world ends tomorrow. Surely that was not traumatizing for the children of the 1960s at all. Good Lord. There are pictures of people in the rooms, their items on shelves, a bored teenager lounging on one of the bunk beds as if this was just any old room to be bored in and not an actual bomb shelter. It is amazing what the human mind can get used to. But who were these people? They weren't random, they were specifically chosen by that original plan. Members of the town that had specific roles once inside the bunker. There was a security committee, quote, who were in charge of keeping order amongst the residents, end quote. They also kept stock of food and other supplies, and they were in charge of preparing weapons if they were needed. There was also the medical committee, who were prepared to treat ailments of the residents, and most curiously, the agricultural committee, who was, quote, in charge of assigning jobs to members of the group for the purpose of growing crops after leaving the shelter, end quote. They had seeds in the bunker. Despite how ominous this all was, somehow they had hope for life after the apocalypse. The Pulse magazine article describes those invited to the bunker as, quote, 100 members of 25 prominent local families, doctors, lawyers, a bank president, a minister, and even Mount Dora's mayor, end quote. Some people were invited and they did not accept the offer. One was a contractor who helped build the bunker. He declined because his children were in school away from Mount Dora. If the worst happened, he would be without them. A grim reality that Pat Frank himself, the man who inspired the creation of the bunker, he pondered about it after he heard of his book inspiring the construction of the fallout shelter. He found it to be a troubling decision. Say someone visited you from out of town. You go in the bunker and they remain above. That's an unfair situation by his measure and by mine. But that imbalance of who gets to be a part of the bunker and who does not, that was built into the plan from the beginning. Those who were invited, there was a pretty explicit line of demarcation over who mattered to those who built the bunker and those who did not. It was built for the wealthiest families in town. Hear that again. It was built for the wealthiest families in town. business leaders, political leaders, and the rich. The affluent of Mount Dora were the only ones with a big functioning bomb shelter under an orange grove ready for them if the world came to an end. Think about that. They spent $2,000 to buy in. That's roughly $20,000 today. And they spent $200 a year to retain upkeep of their private rooms in the underground oasis just for them. If, for example, the Cuban Missile Crisis took the Cold War's temperature up a bit, only those wealthy families of Mount Dora had anywhere to hide. And no one else in the city even knew that the bunker was there. Quote, they were fairly successful in keeping the project secret from the local public, who they feared would demand access in an actual emergency. End quote. It remained a secret, and it was never used. Eventually, the catacombs fell into disrepair. All the way down south, Peanut Island, JFK's bunker, it wasn't even acknowledged by the U.S. government until 1974, over a decade after Kennedy was assassinated in Dallas in 1963. I hope that one day that museum reopens and we can visit the strange spot again, a walk down memory lane of a frightening time in our country's history. As for the Mount Dora catacombs, that same era, the 1970s, is when the facility was no longer kept up. All the maintenance was shut off, no more climate control, and no one to foot the bill. Quote, many of the families had either died or moved away, end quote, having likely only ever spent one night in their private bunker, just a test run. Today, it's not open to the public by any means. Reports indicate that it is infested with bugs, palmettos, covered in mold, and it has fallen into the natural splendor of Florida muck. The Florida land giveth, and the Florida land taketh away. Some have been let inside, journalists seeking to take photographs of what remains. Pulse magazine was allowed within, and their article details many of these photographs. Abandoned Florida has many as well. In writing this episode, I found myself staring at the photographs, haunted. It genuinely gives me a pit in my stomach just looking at them. There's something deeply unsettling about seeing the objects of everyday life. Jigsaw puzzles, lamps, bookshelves, books, a kitchen, a dollhouse, the things that you have in your home, but they're covered in rot, mildew, decay, rust, like leaving a concrete block home in the middle of a swamp to let the elements take over. The warm, wet air and lots of time have decayed all that was left inside. And though there's nothing paranormal about these photos, it's like looking at a ghost caught on camera, something from long ago left behind that somehow in some form still exists today. Today, it's the remains of an anxiety gone by, but all too present today, a fear of things we cannot control. The catacombs serve as a reminder that the present day is not the first era of American life where things are frightening in the news every day. No, we have been afraid before. All you need to see to prove that is the bunker with forgotten items left at one time to prepare for a horrifying possibility. It is a tomb of one city's fears, buried forever now under an orange grove. Thank you so much for listening to this episode of Wait 5 Minutes. I'm so glad that you are here. I've been wanting to tell you this story for a long time, and it has been giving me the heebie-jeebies for like 2 years. So I'm glad I finally got to give that story to you, and I hope it creeped you out a little bit as well, because boy, it creeped me out. If you enjoyed this episode, please consider leaving a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. Send it along to a friend. Find the show on Instagram or Facebook at WFMPod, or send me an email at WFMPod@gmail.com. I look forward to hearing from you. I'd like to give a thank you to Pulse Magazine and Abandoned Florida. I've included links at the top of the episode description so you can go and check out those articles, see the photos, and dig in even more, because there's even more that we did not have time to get into today. So go check those out, and thank you to them. All the music used in this episode was originally composed. All right, folks, we are back at it next week. We have so many things to talk about. I'm really excited to dive into some more history with you next week. But I have to tell you, our finale, it is a two-part finale digging into a corner of American history I've always been fascinated by, the World's Fair. And there's going to be some bonus episodes soon because I'm getting to talk about something very exciting on the show soon. I am going to the Florida Film Festival. If you're a listener to this show, if you're in Orlando, you want to go to the Florida Film Festival, I'm going to be there. Come say hi, and we're going to be talking about it on the show for a very special bonus episode, maybe a few bonus episodes. We'll see. But until then, I will see you next Monday for another jam-packed history episode. Until then, be good to yourself, be good to others, drink more water, and go Gator and muddy the water. Have a great week. I will see you next Monday.